From the Partnership for Public Service, you're listening to Transition Lab, a behind-the-scenes look at presidential transitions. I'm David Marchik. Today, we're focusing on the transition to power of President Jimmy Carter. And we have two prominent Americans who played a huge role in the campaign, the transition, and the Carter presidency. First, Stu Eisenstadt, who was President Carter's, then Governor Carter's, chief domestic policy advisor on the campaign. He played the same role during the Carter presidency, and he held a number of senior positions in the Clinton administration, including Deputy Secretary of Treasury. He recently released an authoritative book on the Carter presidency entitled President Carter, The White House Years, and is one of the experts on the Carter presidency. Also with him is David Rubenstein, who was Stu's deputy on the campaign and in the White House in the domestic policy advisor's role. He subsequently went on to found the Carlyle Group, one of the largest asset managers in the world, and is one of the United States' well-known and top philanthropists. And for me, outside of my parents, these two individuals probably have had the greatest impact on my life because I worked for and with Stu for many years, and then for and with David, and combined, I worked for 23 years with them. So thank you very much for being here. And we're here to talk about the Carter transition and the impact of that transition on the Carter presidency. So this podcast, our work at the Partnership for Public Service, is about effective planning and the linkage between effective planning and a transition to effective government. And the point of this podcast will be that the Carter transition was deeply flawed and had a big impact on the presidency. But before going to kind of perhaps the more critical points of this discussion and the problems with the Carter transition, maybe just briefly, Stu, lay out some of the accomplishments of the Carter administration, which you've written about with eloquence in your book, President Carter, The White House Years.
Well, notwithstanding the very difficult transition, which we'll get into, the fact is he's the most underappreciated, most consequential one-term president in modern American history. 70% of all of our major domestic proposals were passed by the Congress. The energy security we enjoy today rests on the foundation of his three major energy bills. All the ethics legislation in an ethically challenged Washington was as a result of President Carter's leadership. He was the greatest environmental president since Theodore Roosevelt, doubling the size of our national park system through the Alaska Lands Bill, a great consumer champion, totally transforming our entire transportation system, bringing airline deregulation to the middle class and really saving railroads and trucks. He, as a Deep South president, appointed more women and more African Americans, Hispanics, and Jews to senior positions in the administration and the judgeships than all 38 presidents before him put together. He and Mondale created the modern vice presidency. Internationally, Camp David and the Egypt-Israel peace agreement were the single greatest personal presidential diplomatic achievement, I think, in history of the United States. He brought human rights to Latin America and to the Soviet Union. He created a new era in Latin America with the Panama Canal Treaty and really helped democratize Latin America. And he recognized and opened diplomatic relations with China. Mm-hmm. And, of course, our Achilles' heel was Iran. Mm-hmm. But these were huge, huge accomplishments at home and abroad.
So let's go to the transition. In one sense, Carter modernized transition planning because he was really the first president in the history of the United States. Truman tried, but he was the first president that actually diverted significant resources, both personnel and campaign resources, funding, to transition planning. Why did he think that was important, Stu or David?
Yes. I mean, I think the reason was Jimmy Carter is an engineer. He believes in planning and in advanced planning. And he felt that if he could get a running head start by having a transition team begin to put together the kinds of policies that we would implement, that this would help his presidency. Actually, the reverse happened. And the reason is that David and I were heading the policy staff of the campaign. And unbeknownst to us until about a month before the election, Jimmy Carter had a parallel policy planning group for the transition headed by Jack Watson, who was a young partner of his closest friend, Charlie Curbo. And Jack had literally 50 people working on policy issues parallel to us, but without any vetting.
And you guys were running the campaign, the policy, and you knew nothing about this.
I knew only at the very end, and I went to see Jack twice, but we were so totally consumed with trying to win the election, with putting out policy papers, with answering press questions, that no one had the opportunity to even think about what Jack was doing. It seemed like a sort of Netherland activity. But what happened then was that after the election, Jack took three black huge binders full of policy recommendations, not one of which had been vetted politically, not one of which had been shared with us, and went down to Plains and gave it to Carter. And Carter remarkably appointed Jack to head transition planning instead of the campaign manager and his really brilliant campaign strategist, Ham Jordan. So here we had two parallel groups, Jack's working very much in secret because that's the way Carter wanted it, and our policy group, and there had to be a collision, and there was.
And I guess that actually a little before the election, there were some leaks from the Watson group, or maybe he talked to the press, and there were news stories about what Carter would do after he's elected. And you didn't know anything about this, and that caused tension and also didn't look that good for the campaign since it looked uncoordinated.
Yes, absolutely. There were leaks from – actually not from us, from Jack's operation. And they were leaking some of the more provocative suggestions, which had not, again, been politically vetted. And this exposed the fact that there was this parallel group. It's that mm-hmm. – those leaks that led me to finally go to Jack's office and say, you know, what's happening here?
Right. And David, you wanted to add something?
Well, I mean, to say that this was the 1976 or then 1977 would have been the first time that a Democratic president had been elected to succeed a Republican president since 1960 or 59, 60, 61. And in that case, if you go back and you probably have maybe talked to some people mm-hmm. about that, what John Kennedy did was very modest. There was no money allocated for the from the federal government for the transition post the election. No money was allocated pre the election. And all he did was apparently asked Richard Neustadt to write a memo and I think Clark Clifford to write a memo. And basically the transition was run out of his townhouse in Georgetown and a little bit out of the father's house in Palm Beach. I think President Carter or President-elect Carter wanted to do something different and have a more systematic view of things. He was, as Stuart said, an engineer, always wanted to have everything, you know, be very systematic. And he just he had the ability to bifurcate. Sometimes your brain can have two lobes to it and they don't have necessarily work together. So he had a lobe for the campaign and a lobe working on the transition, and he didn't really see that they had to interact in a bit. And I think that was a part of the
and
problem.
So did either of you go to President, then candidate Carter and say, what's going on? Or you just dealt with Jack Watson?
Well, first, during the campaign itself, as I mentioned, about a month before the election, when the leaks started to occur, I did go to see Jack. But afterward, I went to see Ham Jordan, because Ham was in the same uncomfortable position I was. I think Jack wanted the position I ended up getting as domestic advisor, or perhaps chief of staff if Carter would have one. And he was cutting out the person who had planned the entire campaign going back 3 or 4 years with his famous memoranda. And so Ham and I were very much together on this, as was Jody Powell and Frank Moore and all the major campaign people. So we left it to Ham to go to see President Carter. Now, what President Carter did, or President-elect Carter, is he said to Jack and to me and to all the other people, write out a job description of how you see your job. Well, mine and Jack's were quite similar.
Right.
And finally, he realized that there wasn't room for two of us. So he said, why don't you try to work it out? So the way we worked it out is I would be the policy advisor. We would develop policy. We would develop legislation. Jack would help work with state and local governments to implement it. Mine was a much more senior position, but that's the way it finally worked out. And it only worked out that way, I think, because Ham insisted that I have the top policy position.
Well, remember, Hamilton, Jordan, and Jody Powell basically gave several years of their life to help get Carter elected. And I think Carter looked at politics as being a bit dirty.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you guys are the political people. You got me elected. Now I have to govern. So thank you for getting me elected. But now I have to govern. And the guys who have all the fancy degrees and who have all the credentials in Washington, that's who should govern. But thank you very much for getting me elected. And then I think Hamilton and Jody went to President-elect Carter and said, hey, we got you here and we know a lot about politics and you kind of owe us something. And I think Carter in the end kind of went in their direction.
And perhaps one of the lessons learned that President Bush implemented and that President Obama implemented was that to have an effective transition planning apparatus, but that has to be subservient to the campaign, and then they need to merge peacefully after the election. So, I mean, do you have some thoughts on lessons learned from the problems that you experienced and what either current Democratic candidates should be thinking about or even President Trump should be thinking about as he's running for a second term?
I think in this particular case, it was a problem clearly in the transition because you had people fighting over, jockeying over positions, and you couldn't really prepare that well for the new administration because people didn't really know who's going to get what jobs. I think Stewart didn't firmly get his position until 2 or 3 weeks before the swearing in.
Which is incredible because you'd basically given 2 years of your life to then-Governor Carter. And I didn't know this about you. I've known you for 25 years until I read David Rubenstein's oral history at the Miller Center in Virginia and your oral history that there was just this chaos and you didn't know what you were doing until 10 days before the election.
Yes, and Frank Moore, who was a congressional liaison, didn't learn until a week before that that was going to be his job. So because you had these parallel structures, because you had this clash, it took up an enormous amount of the time that otherwise would have been used. And this points to a very important point, I think, in the transition process, not just for us but for future presidents. And that is even the best laid plans of a transition have a huge disadvantage. You don't have a formal interagency process. You can't draw on the expertise of the budget office or of most of the departments. Mm-hmm. And so putting together, for example, the economic stimulus package, which Carter wanted to do from day one when he came into office, ended up with flaws. The $50 stimulus, the rebate,
right,
for example, ended up biting the dust because it hadn't been well thought through. So you have to be very careful about the kinds of decisions you make in a transition. When we have a chance more during this interview, I'd like to go into some other substantive decisions that were made and governance decisions during the transition that were really quite seminal.
Let me mention what I think was the problem to some extent with Governor Carter. He'd had a relatively modest-sized and capable staff in terms of ability. They weren't extremely famous as a governor. And Governor Carter was always the smartest person in the room in his view, and he probably was when he was governor. He didn't really feel he had to have very powerful people at the White House staff because in his view, everything was going to be in the cabinet.
Right.
And because he was running against a strong White House staff that Nixon had had, he didn't want to have everybody think it's going to be a White House staff just like Nixon.
So he wanted to do the opposite of Watergate.
Right. He wanted to have
Nixon.
A cabinet government. He kept talking about cabinet government. So when the meetings that Stewart helped organize down in the Pond House, so-called Miss Lillian's house, they were really de facto interviews for people who would be cabinet officers. Carter was obsessed with getting the cabinet done. The White House staff, well, staff people are not that significant. Who cares about staff people? We'll deal with that later. Rather than most people in Washington today saying, figure out who your top White House staff people are going to be and then deal with the cabinet, he did it the different way and didn't work out
and
that
Stu,
well.
Stu, you were 30 or 31, and David, you were 26 or 27, and you were perhaps two of the more experienced and accomplished White House staff. I mean, were you actually qualified for these positions when you got them?
I wasn't. Stuart was qualified. He'd worked in the White House before. I wasn't qualified because I was relatively young, but and didn't have that much experience. But no White House staff is completely fully qualified. You have a few people qualified, but remember, White House staffs are generally filled with relatively younger people who've given their time to campaign. So 50-year-old people who are at the top of their career in Wall Street or in a corporate setting, they don't usually give up that and go work in a campaign. You get 20-year-olds working in campaigns, 30-year-olds working in campaigns, and therefore they often work in the White House staff. Now, occasionally you'll get a Jim Baker, but that's a rare situation.
Look, you had with Johnson the Texas Mafia. You had with Nixon the California Mafia. Each president brings the young people who are willing to drop everything. Their families have almost no income for 2 years and kill yourself on the campaign trail. I mean, no one can imagine the brutality of the hours and demands. I mean, even working in the White House is better because at least you have a place to go home to, and you know there'll be a tomorrow. You make one mistake in a campaign and it can be fatal. But what happened here was the following. He decided, for the reasons David very aptly said, to be the opposite of Nixon.
Right.
So Nixon had Haldeman as the all-powerful chief of staff who blocked everyone from seeing him. So he decided he was going to be his own chief of staff. And actually, Dick Cheney, who became chief of staff for President Ford, whom we beat, initially Ford did not have a chief of staff when Nixon resigned.
Right, for the same reasons.
For the same reasons. And he warned Ham very visibly, something he took a bicycle wheel that had been given to him by his staff because they had initially in the Ford White House done the so-called spokes of the wheel. Five or six aides have equal access to the president, no chief of staff, saying, this is broken, don't do this.
Right.
But Carter insisted on doing it. And that meant no one to combine policy and politics. It meant no one to set priorities. What goes first? Who has to be told they have to wait? Then, for the reasons that David said, he didn't think the White House staff was that important. He was for cabinet government. He cut the White House staff by a third.
Mm-hmm.
It was already very small. He took away our door-to-door limousine service, meaning we wasted an hour going up and back in terms of not being able to read. He sold the Sequoia, which was the presidential yacht, which was one of the greatest presidential lobbying tools ever. Almost sold Camp David, except Rosalynn objected. And all of these things were being done during the campaign in a sense to be the opposite
right.
of Nixon.
Right.
And speaking of the Porto, some of the people in the White House staff, senior people, Nixon, Ford, had limousine service or drivers taking them for their home back and forth. In subsequent years, we now have a situation where senior White House aides get Secret Service protection. And Carter wanted none of that. So Stewart, for example, lived in Chevy Chase, Maryland. He would drive in his car every day by himself, come to work. Then he would go home at night for dinner with his kids. Then he would come back at night, drive back again, and then drive back again. And so he's driving like 3 hours a day in the car, and there's no cell phones in those days. So you kind of waste a lot of time. There was a lot of penny-wise and pound-foolish things, I think, that we did.
So there's some other things that I think are very important. He said that he wanted David and me to put together all of the campaign promises that we had made. And we said, we don't think this is such a good idea, Mr. President-elect, because it'll now be something that people can shoot at when we don't fulfill all of these. No, he insisted. And November 30th, 1976, David and I wrote him a memo, which compiled, and I've given it to you here at the podcast to look at, hundreds of campaign promises.
And then he actually published it, too.
But, of course, it was released publicly, and it was published by CCH Publishing House.
The reason we had to do that was there was no thing called the Internet in those days. And, therefore, nobody really knew what he had said in interviews, in questionnaires and speeches. So we, in the transition, we gathered it all up, and no one else had it. So now it was evident for everybody, and people used it against him during the 4 years as president. They said, well, here's what you said your promise was, and here's
so
what you actually—
you said to him, we don't think this is a good idea,
well,
and he said—
Stewart, I think, may have said it to him.
Yeah, I did. But here's another consequence on the personnel side. Because of the cabinet government decision and the denuding of the White House staff and the power of the White House, the president basically gave the cabinet secretaries free rein to name their own top deputies, deputy secretaries, undersecretaries, assistant secretaries, who therefore were more loyal to them than they were to the president. Not a good idea. In addition, one really seminal personnel decision was made after one of the CIA briefings in Plains at his home as president-elect. I was the only staff person there. And there was a break in the briefing, and he took me out the side door of his house, and he said, you've managed both foreign and domestic policy. I'm thinking of naming Cy Vance as Secretary of State and Zbigniew Brzezinski as National Security Advisor. What do you think? I said, each individually would be great, but putting them together would be a serious mistake. And he said, why? And I said, because I've seen during the campaign, they have diametrically opposite views on the most crucial issue you'll be facing, which is the Soviet Union. One is a dove and the other is a hawk. And the president said, well, I like different opinions. I can handle it. But this caused a dissonance in our foreign policy that went throughout the administration.
No chief of staff, a flawed personnel process, and this dissonance between the campaign and the transition. What was the impact on governing for either of you? David, you wrote the famous memo that lists all his proposals. What was the impact of governing because of this flawed transition process?
Well, Jimmy Carter really believed that he wanted to honor his campaign promises, and many of those promises were put together by people who were no longer in really positions of power. In other words, we had a small policy staff, but the people who were running the cabinet departments, they hadn't bought into some of those promises,
right.
So they didn't really feel that they were things that he wanted or they wanted, and so we had conflicts from time to time in that regard. And it was a complicated situation. I would say that Carter is a very, very smart person, but he wanted to engineer everything, and he didn't prioritize. He wanted to do so many things. He did a lot of things, but he might have gotten more done if he had prioritized things a little bit better.
The problem was so evident. We threw so much up at the Congress that Tip O'Neill at leadership breakfasts would say week after week, you've got to tell us your priorities. We can't absorb all of this. We had the economic stimulus package, a commitment he made December 9th, 1976, without any forewarning in the transition, that he was going to have a comprehensive energy bill within 90 days of inauguration, when energy wasn't even a campaign issue. Water projects hit lists, welfare reform, tax reform, SALT II, Panama Canal, all of these things came to Congress in the first year or so, and they just bombarded Congress. So we actually accomplished, as I mentioned at the beginning, an enormous amount, but it always paled in comparison to what we threw up.
And so he adjusted later and actually appointed a chief of staff and actually—
Well,
he did.
He did it in two ways. First, but only in the— after 2 years, appointed Hamm as chief of staff. But second, after about 9 months, when it was clear that the absence of priorities was really hurting us, he had Vice President Mondale head a small group. David and I worked on the domestic side, Brzezinski and David Aaron on the national security side, and we set the following priorities, those things that would be key presidential priorities requiring presidential time and personal effort, those things that were White House decisions but would take less of the president's time, those things that could be handled at the cabinet level. And that really helped, and that we did that every one of the succeeding years. But it was that first crucial year where that wasn't done.
And that's typically when administrations accomplish the most, is their first year, because
right.
they have the mandate and there's
right.
energy.
Now, Jimmy Carter became president of the United States when he was 52 years old. His senior staff people were by and large in their 30s. And it was hard for them to tell him no and for him to say no, because he would say, look, I'm 20 years older, I'm smarter, I'm whatever. It's very good to have a chief of staff who is maybe older than you or at least your age who can say no to you and get away with it, which is what Jim Baker, I think, effectively did when he was chief of staff. And it worked much better. When you have young people, it's hard for them to convince the president.
Carter didn't want a lot of Washington hands in the White House because it was a kind of an anti-establishment campaign, post-Watergate, anti-Nixon campaign. And what was the impact of that, Stu?
The impact was devastating because he was inexperienced, as David mentioned. The White House staff was inexperienced because they were all Georgia people, the so-called Georgia Mafia. And he didn't leaven that staff with someone like Bob Strauss, who was the former chairman of the Democratic National Committee.
And an old Washington hand.
And an old Washington hand. And Reagan learned that lesson. So yes, Reagan, of course, brought in his campaign people. But he leavened it with someone like Jim Baker, who was a Washington hand, and who, by the way, had been the campaign manager for his chief opponent,
right.
George H.W.
Right.
Bush. And Baker is, in my opinion, as responsible as any one person for Reagan's success
mm-hmm.
in his first term, because he brought that kind of experience. Had we had one or two people that had that kind of experience and the age factor that David mentioned, they could have gone into the president and said, the emperor has no clothes. You can't do
this,
Mr. President.
I want to ask you both a personal question, which I learned when I was reading. I've
right.
known both of you for a long time, but I
right.
never knew this about you, David, which is that you said in an interview right after Carter lost that the transition was perhaps the hardest time of your life. It was the most stressful.
Well, remember, I was only 27 years old.
But then, when you reflect back, why was it so hard? Because the uncertainty, because of...
Well, because we didn't know what was going to happen. We won the election. President Carter won, but we were supporters. But we didn't know during the transition whether we were going to have jobs or what the jobs would be. And so even Stewart, as close as he was to Carter, didn't really know, as I mentioned earlier, until a couple weeks before, what his job was going to be. And so, you know, it was stressful because we had to put out the fires of everybody coming to Washington looking for jobs. Everybody who worked in the campaign all over the country wanted a job. We didn't have authority. We didn't know whether we had jobs ourselves. And the transition, there weren't a lot of security in those days. So we were working out of an old HEW building, and people could just walk in and look for jobs. It was a little strange. I would like to comment on the second term phenomenon. Very often, I think Carter may have had the same phenomenon that maybe the current president may have. When you're president of the United States, you are, you know, think you get the best information, you make the best decisions and so forth. But you also think at the end of 4 years, you've got this job down pretty well. You know how to do it. And therefore, you don't really plan that much for the second term. I don't really know if Carter had won that election exactly what his priorities were for the second term. I think it's just like more of the same. But it wasn't like he had said it during the campaign. Here are the 10 things I'm going to do in the second term. Because you're kind of worn out. You kind of tell people, this is what I did, and elect me if you like what I did. Right now, today, if you were to sit down with President Trump, I'm not sure he could say, here are the 10 things I want to do in a second term if I'm elected. So I think somebody has to, in a second term presidency, really focus at the end of that first term on what the person's going to do that's really different or better than he did in the first term.
We had Josh Bolton and Dennis McDonough on the podcast, and they're two former second-term chief of staffs, and they said exactly the same thing, that the work in year four, preparing for year five, is absolutely crucial because you have huge turnover, Senate confirmations are taking longer, and then year five is a policy window where you can accomplish a lot, but if you're not prepared. So let's fast forward to year four. You're running for re-election, and David, I've heard you describe this many times, that you were convinced you were going to win. Carter was going to win right up until the last moment.
Yeah. Yes, that's right.
And he got, I mean, he lost all but several states. Well, so how did you?
All right. There's a phenomenon in psychology, I guess it's called cognitive dissonance, which is to say you believe what you want to believe and you don't believe the thought that doesn't go along with your preconceived notions. So our view was Carter was very smart, Reagan not as smart. Carter was experienced, Reagan not experienced. Carter was a moderate, Reagan was too conservative. So how could a former conservative, of a governor, very conservative, former governor of California, former movie actor, 69 years old, which was then the oldest person ever who had run for president, how could he possibly beat a very smart Carter, who wasn't his fault we had hostage, wasn't his fault we had gas lines? So we thought the polling was inaccurate because people were not going to tell a pollster, I'm really going to vote for Carter, because they wanted to say, well, I might vote for Reagan because I want to show Carter that I really – no, one wanted to be on his toes more. There was a Bradley factor. Tom Bradley was mayor of L.A.,
right,
running for governor of California. People didn't want to admit that he wouldn't vote for a black person. He was black. So they would say they're voting for him, and it turned out there weren't a lot of support. We thought the same thing was true. People were kind of upset with Carter, so they were going to say, I'm going to vote for Reagan. But when they got into the voting booth, they wouldn't pull the lever for Ronald Reagan, inexperienced, too conservative, older guy. We were wrong.
And well, David, except there was one thing to back up David's instinct, and that is notwithstanding a blowout loss, 10 million votes, only six states that we won, the fact is that going into the first and only debate, which was held 8 days before the election, which was a horrible mistake,
mm-hmm,
Reagan was a great debater. It took a lot of the fear factor that this guy was trigger-happy, he was too conservative, he was an aw-shucks kind of guy. They had stolen our briefing book that David and I put together and knew what lands they were making. Jim Baker's admitted that, and I put it in the book. But even with losing the debate, the last weekend before the Tuesday election, the polls, not just Pat Caddell's internal polls, CBS, ABC, NBC, had us ahead or even and moving ahead. And then what happened was, on the Sunday before the Tuesday vote, we were at the Hilton Hotel in the Chicago airport. And I got a call about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, be on the Air Force One in 45 minutes. The president's going back. He's gotten a new offer from Iran. I begged him not to go back. I said, just look at the offer. Don't go back. It'll bring the whole issue back. And then when he was on the plane, Rafshoon, Ham, and I said, okay, if you're going to do it, this is obviously not enough to break the hostage crisis open. Blast the hell out of him for interfering in our election. Instead, he gave a sort of moderate statement saying, well, you know, it's a step forward, not enough. The whole floor collapsed at that point because it brought the whole hostage crisis back. And what had been an even race turned into a landslide loss.
What we didn't realize at the time, and only history has proven to be the case, we thought Carter is a relatively nice guy. He's not a bomb thrower the way Reagan was portrayed as. So surely the Iranians would want to negotiate with this nicer guy, Jimmy Carter, than the tough, tough guy who might nuclear bomb Iran. We were wrong. They were doing anything they could to make sure that Carter never got the hostage released while he was president. We just didn't know that. Had we known that, we would have probably done different things. I would also point out one thing that, about the debates. We had one debate. Carter had the same view on debates that Barack Obama had and that George W. Bush had and other presidents who have to debate when they're an incumbent. I'm president of the United States. I know everything. The other guy doesn't know anything. Carter didn't really want to prepare, and it showed in the first debate he wasn't that well prepared because he hadn't rehearsed that much. Reagan, it was pretty well rehearsed. Barack Obama in his first debate didn't do that well in his reelection, and George W. Bush in his first debate in reelection didn't do that well. If you're running for reelection as president of the United States, you've got to prepare for those debates. You can't assume you're hanging around the Oval Office. It's you're going to know everything because the debates are much different than what you have to do when you're president.
Let's talk about the transition out. So did you or did President Carter and his team do any planning or any work to effectively hand off the reins to President Reagan?
Yes. I have to say to you, frankly, the Reagan people, at least the ones I met, cared nothing about what we had to say. They felt they had wiped us out. We were a spent force. This was a new ideology, a new Republican majority, and they met it with real disdain. And Reagan did learn lessons from our transition. He appointed Jim Baker as his chief of staff, for example. But there was really a disdain for, at least that I saw, for anything that Carter and his staff had to offer.
So, David, a lot of people that want to work in government or do work in government will listen to this. I want to go back to something Stu said, which is when you're in government, everybody thinks you're smart, you're funny, you're handsome, you're good looking. So you've had a very successful career. When you left the Carter administration, were people banging down the doors to hire you?
They were banging down the doors to keep me away from hiring, being hired by them. Basically, Stuart had been a partner in a law firm, and his former law firm was happy to have him back, and he had other offers as well. I had only practiced law 2 years, and selling access to the Carter White House wasn't that productive when Carter wasn't president. So it was more difficult for me. And I really didn't find law firms were dying to hire me. But, you know, you have to remember when people come in and tell you how great you are, you have to take that with a grain of salt because in the end, if you're out of power, they don't really care about you anymore.
So the great story really with David, we bonded very closely. I mean, we worked in the campaign 24/7. We had adjoining offices in the West Wing 24/7. All the pressures were on us equally. When we lost the election, my former law firm, Powell, Goldstein, Fraser & Murphy in Atlanta, wanted to open a new Washington office. Elliot Goldstein, who was the son of the founder and a very eminent lawyer, he'd been head of the American Bar Association's corporate division, came to interview, and I said, look, I really want you to interview David Rubenstein. He's my deputy. He's a really brilliant, most hardworking guy you've ever seen. We want to come as a pair. So he interviewed David, and I said, okay, Elliot, you're ready to take both of us. He said, no, we want you, but not David. And I said, you got to be kidding. I mean, the guy's brilliant. And, you know, University of Chicago, Hill experience, 4 years in the White House, tremendously energetic and indefatigable. Why don't you want David to come with me? And he said, we don't need two of you. Here I am. And David has taken the Buffett pledge, and I'm still doing timesheets.
Let me tell you one other related story. When I had been a young lawyer at Paul Weiss, Stuart, I always thought that Paul Weiss is a good law firm. And after the election was over, the partners at Paul Weiss came down to see Stuart and said, we want you to head up our new Washington office. It's just a great firm. It's, you know, even more famous than the firm he'd been in Atlanta. And I think he was intrigued with it. And he said, well, let me think about it, so forth, and maybe I'll do it. I don't know. And then he didn't hear from him for a month or two. And finally, he caught him and said, well, what happened? And they said, well, actually, we concluded you were too close to Carter. And in fact, because Carter had gone down so much in popularity, they were afraid that they were going to be hurt by being associated with Carter. Something like that. Is that right?
Yes, it's right. And actually, the person who initially interviewed me was Ted Sorensen. He was an early supporter of Jimmy Carter in 75, 76. He had been named as CIA director. And unfortunately, Carter caved to pressure from Senator Byrd and others to pull him back because Ted had been a conscious objector. But yes, there was an initial great interest in my joining, and then suddenly evaporated.
So one transition story you haven't gotten to, you won't get to, and I'll just tell you briefly.
Please.
When George Washington was elected president, he decided to have a cabinet. There were only four cabinet officers then.
Okay, and Secretary of State, Secretary of Treasury.
Attorney General. And the Postmaster General.
Okay.
So he picks as his attorney, as his Secretary of State, Thomas Jefferson, who is in France as ambassador. Thomas Jefferson doesn't hear about this for 4 months. When he comes back from France, he lands in the United States in New York, and they say, you've been selected 4 months ago to be Secretary of State. And he said, oh, okay, I'll think about it. Maybe I'll do it. Oh, and the State Department managed to survive for four months without a Secretary of State. Well, it was a little more complicated these days than it was then. There is a Chinese curse, and the curse is, may you be condemned to live in a time of transition, which is to say, transition's difficult, and getting through a transition's never going to be easy. So this project is well advised. But any transition is going to have its flaws. You can look at the lessons of the past, but just remember, all transitions are difficult because people are grabbing for power, for positions, and it's a complicated thing. For people who think about it and study the history of it, I think we'll do better than people who ignore it, though.
Yeah. Well, Stu Eisenstadt, David Rubenstein, thank you very much for your time, and more importantly, thank you very much for the service to our country.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If you like Transition Lab, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and give a review on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast apps.